Hi, welcome to the Friday edition of On Par with Anthony Scorsia. Pleased to be joined by Rex Hoggard of the Golf Channel. Rex, if you could think of, if you could go back right now and talk to the guy that came out of the Marines in 1990, and said that you were going to be on TV basically almost every other day of the week, What would that guy say to you?
Let your hair grow out. I never let my hair grow out after I got out of the Marines. I always thought, well, I have to leave it short now. I mean, that's what I was used to. And now you know, we're both at the point of our lives now where it's like, man, I miss my hair. Right. I wish I still had that.
Yeah.
Probably would be very surprised.
Yeah.
I went to journalism school after I got out of the Marines. I wanted to be a newspaper writer. I wanted to be a sports writer. I mean, that's what I dreamed of doing. I mean, Dan Jenkins was my idol, you know, in high school, and that's what I wanted to do. And the way it all kind of came together and I ended up at the Golf Channel, it is a bit surprising, but I think I kind of went with the flow of the new business. I mean, I think Tim Rosefort probably blazed the trail for us, at least in golf, and, you know, he kind of led the way. And you look at where media is going just in general, it's going online, it's going into social media, and it's going on to not just TV anymore, it's going on to video, which is, you know, now you get it. My kids never watch TV, they watch their phones.
So right.
You have to kind of just roll with it. But I'd be shocked. I'd have to be honest with you. I'd shake my head and tell you, you were crazy. I'm not doing that.
Why the Marines? I'm just curious what led to that.
Very proud that I was in the Marines, obviously.
Yeah.
But no, it was kind of by accident. I was 17 in high school. I wasn't smart enough for college. I didn't have money for college. You know, a lot of people are in this situation.
Sure.
So my thought was, well, I'll just join the service, no specific service. And my dad was a firefighter. My sister was a police officer. My brother was a firefighter, you know, kind of blue-collar civil servants.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, you know, I wanted to be an MP, and the Marines were the only one that would let me become an MP at 17.
Oh, really?
So it was just kind of just by design. I was dead set on doing that, and it turned out to be the best decision.
I mean, sure.
On top of all the other things that I just mentioned, just wasn't smart enough, didn't have good enough grades, didn't have the money for it. It more importantly, it gave me the discipline that I look back on, and then I would have never accomplished anything that I accomplished, whatever that might be, without the Marines and the discipline that they instilled in me.
Sure. And then where did this passion for journalism, was that something that, you know, you'd always had and then sort of reacquainted yourself with after you got out of the Marines, or was it something that came after the Marines?
Reacquainted myself. That's exactly what happened. Again, you grow up, you know, I'm like any other kid, you grow up reading the newspapers and you dream about having these jobs and how cool it would be. I was a baseball fan, so, you know, you dreamed that was your dream job. Right. And but no, I was going to go into law enforcement. So when I did get out of the Marines, I went to college, and the plan was to get a criminal justice degree and go into law enforcement. And but somewhere along the line, I ended up just taking a journalism class just as an elective.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed it, and it just kind of built from there. And in my sophomore year of college, I ended up getting a job at the Orlando Sentinel, the newspaper in the town. I went to the University of Central Florida, and just fell in love with it. And then, you know, everything just kind of diverted from there. And I got very, very lucky. I ended up with some awesome bosses who were very tough on me and taught me how to do the job the right way, I feel like. And so that is, I was very fortunate on that front.
I feel like that when you talk to people who love what they do, there is a bit of luck when it comes to finding your passion or something. You know, you say, yeah, when you do something you love, you don't really work. And I know that feeling, and I know you know that feeling. But it does come with, like, winning a golf tournament. You need to get some breaks.
Oh, I got lucky.
There's no
doubt about it. I mean, again, I mentioned I ended up with some unbelievable bosses, some unbelievable coworkers who supported me along the way and you know, just to kind of stumble into it and be able to fulfill my dream. What's interesting is I always loved golf. I played golf growing up, but I wanted to be a baseball writer. And in retrospect, looking back now...
Why baseball? Just because you played baseball and you loved baseball?
Yeah, I mean, I just love the game. But now looking back all these years later in retrospect, I probably would hate baseball right now if I did that. Whereas I don't hate golf. Like, I love being out here. I love playing. You know, I've snuck out a couple times this week. I'll do it next week when I'm in Boston. And it's odd how it kind of played out, because if I was a baseball writer now, I'm sure I'd just be fed up with it.
Where did you play this week?
Well, we snuck out. I went all the way up to Rhode Island when I was coming in. So there's a course up there, and the pro is a very good friend of mine called Shelter Harbor, and it's just a fabulous place, and he's very accommodating and lets me come out. It's a lot of fun.
Nice. Will you get a chance to play this week at all, like somewhere locally or not?
Yeah, I think on Monday.
Well, you're going to play here on Monday, right, because they're doing –
Actually, no. I wish I could play here.
Oh, okay.
Looking at how difficult this golf course is, I'm playing with your shirt there, Deepdale.
Oh, you're playing Deepdale.
Yeah.
Okay.
So a couple of us from the Golf Channel, because we all leave from here to go up to Boston, and you have that extra day built in. So we're on Monday morning.
Monday. We had gotten rained out for a media day here at one point, and so they moved it to this Monday, so we're playing here Monday.
Oh, nice.
So, maybe we'll come back to some other topics, but since we're talking about the golf course, you've traveled all over the country, all over the world, really, covering golf, and it's always interesting when you get a new venue like Glen Oaks. How do you categorize this golf course in terms of being a new entry?
It's a geographic oddity. I just went and walked the front nine. How is it possible that every hole is uphill? Like, eventually you have to go downhill at some point, don't you?
Right.
It's very challenging. It's interesting, the routing. I mean, obviously they had the luxury here of having three nines.
Right, yeah.
So the tour had a lot of leeway. It was interesting talking to Scott Brown yesterday. He was close to the lead. He actually came over and played last year after he missed the cut at Bethpage, at this event.
Sure.
And he talked about the differences. Like the first hole, for example, is a par five for the members and how much he liked it as a par five. It's a very demanding golf course, and I think that's what we've kind of come to expect from this event, the Northern Trust now, the Barclays in the past. Even though you jump around to different golf courses, and they're all very, very good, they all kind of have that same feel, that northeast feel.
Sure.
You have the thick rough. You have to be accurate off the tee. It's very demanding. Par is not a bad score at all. That's the part that fascinates me the most, because it's one thing to jump around. Like, the BMW moves around to different venues.
Right.
And so you go from a Chicago venue, and, you know, they've gone to Cherry Hills.
Right.
And played in Denver, and that's dramatically different. Whereas here, they all kind of have the same feel. You know, each has their own characteristics. Like Plainfield, for example, is one of my favorite clubs, and that's a little bit different than, obviously, Bethpage, which is just a brute. But they all kind of have their similar feels, but it seems like every year you show up here, and it feels familiar, even though we've never been here before.
Right, right. When almost aesthetically, they're all a little different. But underneath, it has that sort of northeast roots. Any input from the players and the young bucks that are coming in here? I know a lot of them play a power game now and stuff like that, but this course seems to be handling it pretty well.
I like the leaderboard after day one. And you know, you always kind of focus on the power game, and this goes back a couple of weeks to the PGA at Quail Hollow, where you really had an eclectic leaderboard. And I think you had that yesterday. Russell Henley, I mean, he's long. I don't like saying that he's short. I mean, I don't like saying Jordan Spieth is short.
You know,
relative to Dustin Johnson, okay, he is shorter.
Sure.
But he still can move the ball 300 yards. I mean, let's don't forget that. I think, but you look at the leaderboard, and it was, at least on day one, it was pretty eclectic. You had Dustin Johnson right behind Russell Henley, two vastly different players when it comes to the power game. Jordan Spieth was interesting talking about it yesterday. He actually compared the greens here to Quail Hollow a few weeks ago for the PGA, pointing out that even though you want to play underneath the hole, that's always the trick when you're on greens like this and it's fast. And he said, but because there's so much movement and so many undulations, it's very difficult. And
right.
I think that's, you know, you always, distance is always a challenge. The rough is always going to be a challenge. But essentially, when you come down to a golf course like this or Quail Hollow, if you're putting guys in uncomfortable positions on the greens where they simply can't put themselves in a position to make a birdie more times than not, I think that's good architecture.
Yeah, I agree. And one of the things that I noticed from the coverage from online and then on the Golf Channel is rarely do you see a lot of guys missing the ball on the low side on the greens, which tells me that they really don't, you know, they're still uncomfortable on the greens and haven't figured them out yet. And I'm sure they will, but I was just surprised that I'd never seen so many PGA Tour players miss the ball on the low side. They always 90% of the time miss it on the high side. So that tells you all you need to know, really.
And there's a sneaky, you know, I always refer to this when I come to the Northeast because it seems like every course I play up here has it. I mean, when, you know, growing up in the South, playing golf in the South, it's, you hit a good putt, it rolls a foot by, foot and a half, whatever the case may be. Up here, there's that sneaky 2, 3, 4 feet of rollout where you feel like you hit a good putt. Next thing you know, you've got an even more demanding putt coming back the other way. And that happens a lot up here.
Yep, absolutely. Want to switch gears and talk about an article you just wrote on golfchannel.com, one that had I found very interesting with Bubba Watson. and being a little more honest than people might, or maybe than some of the executives would have liked him to have been talking about, you know, how his mindset and taking the time off, but in terms of how he thinks week to week as opposed to this big thing. Maybe talk a little bit about that article a little bit.
And, you know, sometimes Bubba's shot full of sodium pentothal sometimes. I mean, sometimes he says things and, you know, I feel like his mouth moves faster than his brain sometimes. But I understood where he was coming from. Essentially, I mean, it's a very good point. He, you know, if he's kind of on the bubble this week, if he doesn't advance to the next playoff event, honestly, he wasn't all that bent out of shape about it. He's going to go home and spend 4 months with his family before he tees it off again next January on the PGA Tour. I think a lot of guys were in that situation. I mean, we just had Rory McIlroy in here earlier in the week talking about there was a genuine excitement in his voice talking about having 3 months off after this playoff stretch and how he's going to build up and get himself healthy in his body and his mind and his game and get ready for 2018. I think we're starting to see that more and more because it does wear you down. I mean, there is a point of diminishing returns when it comes to playing 25, 30 events a year. And I think the best person to describe it, and I don't know that Bubba was really dismissing the playoffs.
No, yeah.
All. I still think that most players would tell you, including Bubba, that the game is better with the playoffs, and I think that's always the ultimate litmus test. Whether or not you and I understand the playoff points or the fans, I don't think that really matters. We have meaningful golf at a time of year when 11 years ago we didn't have meaningful golf.
Yeah.
I mean, they were essentially just playing for nothing, you know? And I think that's been the biggest change. But I love the way Jordan has really boiled this down, and he's the first one to articulate it in a way that I think everyone can really understand. He kind of looks at these first three playoff events as just an extension of the regular season. That all you're really trying to do is keep yourself in a certain position. And then he treats East Lake and the Tour Championship like a major.
Right.
Because you know, year in and year out, I think of the 10 FedEx Cups that have, or Tour Championships that have been played since the introduction of the FedEx Cup, only three of them haven't been won by the winner at East Lake. So your odds are, no matter where you're at, as long as you're in the field at East Lake, if you win, you have a very, very good chance of winning it all. And I think that was, Jordan probably explained it better than Bubba, but I think that was Bubba's point.
Right. And Bubba really has had sort of an off year. I don't know if that has anything to do with the ball change. I mean, people have made a big deal about that or have talked about it a lot. I wonder, I mean, listen, no pro, I mean, I know they're going to get money for whatever it is that they, whatever equipment they're going to use, but I can't imagine that he didn't test it to, you know, to an extent that he didn't, you know, that he felt comfortable with it to make this deal, but yet he hasn't played very well at all year.
He hasn't. I will give Bubba credit. He's never blamed it on the golf ball. I mean, we can sit, you know, at 30,000 feet and speculate all we want. I kind of tend to just to let the players answer the question, and then you can take it from there, and the reader can take it from there. And we've seen this before. I mean, when Rory had to make a big equipment switch this year because Nike Golf got out of the hard goods business, and even along with the injury, the rib injury, which has slowed him down this season, it's also been that equipment change. And look, when you have to completely wholesale change out your bag, there are going to be things that don't work out, even if it's a relatively smooth process that you're going to have to tinker with. It's trial and error. It may feel good on the range. The numbers may add up on the range, but you don't know how it's going to perform once you get it out on the golf course. That's why the guys who seem to stick with the same stuff relatively year in and year out, and I'm talking about a Jordan Spieth, even a Dustin Johnson, those are the guys who normally have the most success.
Yeah. Want to finish, since we are in New York, and New York tends to be seems to always fully back Phil Mickelson, and that he's been in the for whatever reason, people have tried to get to the bottom of that, the reason why they love him so much, and they've dissected it a million ways, but he's been a bit of the story this week, maybe not necessarily for being up on the leaderboard, but the Ryder Cup, and it seems like the President's Cup. It seems like the decision really is almost his at this point.
It was interesting talking with him yesterday. It's fascinating, and look, I think Steve Stricker's a great captain, and I mean he's one of the most enjoyable people to be around. After Phil spoke yesterday, and there was that sort of give and take, that there is the notion that it will be in his lap when the time comes in 2 weeks. If he wants to be a pick, I mean, I'm sure he has enough say in the room. He's done enough for the game. He's played in every single one of the President's Cups. And talking with Steve, he wasn't willing to completely put it all on his shoulders. Mm-hmm. I mean, he said that he's going to talk to the 10 players who qualify. He's going to talk to his four assistant captains. There's a lot of experience in that room. I still believe that it'll be up to Phil. that, yep. I mean, it, regardless of what happens, and the reason I say that, and Steve correctly pointed out that if you look at the way the points are right now, they could change, but if you look at the way they are right now, number 11, Kevin Chappell, he feels like he's a lock. Kevin's played very good golf late in the season. He's on form, would fit well into that team room. But he pointed out that if you look at 12 through 18 on that points list, which Phil is 18,
yeah.
No one has really done much lately. I think I added up yesterday of those seven players, only one of them has a top 10 in the last month, Gary Woodland. So no one is really doing anything. I mean, it's easy to say, well, Phil has had a terrible season, and by his own estimates, I think he'd say he's had a poor season. But the fact is, no one else has really stepped up. And the other half of this is, and I've asked a couple players this, I asked Jordan this yesterday, I asked Steve Stricker, if Phil's not in that team room, and right now I think he has five rookies on that team, who's the leader? I mean, it's either going to fall to Jordan Spieth, who is only 23 years old. I know he's an old head, but he's 23, or Matt Kuchar, and he's been a member of that team for a long time. I'm not sure if he has that leadership quality that Phil brings to the table. If not those guys, then who? I mean, if it's not going to be Phil, then who? And I think that Steve has thought this all through. And unless someone over the next 2 weeks makes a very good argument that it should be me and not Phil, and by that I mean top 10, wins this week, wins next week, somewhere along those lines, I think he would probably lean towards Phil at this point.
Well, and I also think the other part of it is that if someone's going to make a statement for themselves, it better be a big statement, because I think the other thing that people forget is, you know, maybe Phil hasn't played well as of recently, although he said he seems to be coming around and he's getting closer and he's maybe a little frustrated the scores haven't shown it, but he's still Phil Mickelson. He still has a career that backs up pretty good. You know, he's a leader. He's got the career and, you know, how so many wins and six majors or five majors. So I feel like, you know, maybe he's not playing, but he still has a Hall of Fame career.
He has a Hall of Fame career. I don't think you can dismiss the idea of what he does for that team room,
exactly.
Especially with the young players.
Yep.
I think for players of Phil's generation, there was always sort of a grudge and give and take. There was always a competitive edge there was a lot of criticism. There was a lot of jabs going on. I think with the new generation, there was a genuine appreciation for Phil's ability to come in and really give up knowledge. And look, I think Tiger has embraced that in recent years, but Phil has done it for a very long time. And I'll go back to Jordan Spieth's first President's Cup at Muirfield Village, and I asked Steve Stricker about this yesterday. And, I mean, they intentionally sent him out, Steve Stricker, with Jordan Spieth, because they knew that Jordan was nervous. They knew it was going to be a lot of pressure. And, I mean, Jordan played awful the first five holes. And there was a point in that first match that Steve put his arm around Jordan, said, take your time. I've got this. Whenever you're ready, jump in, help me out. And I think that some of the young players might need that. Look, and they're bulldogs. Kevin Kisner is going to end up being a very good player for that team. And you could say the same about Daniel Berger and Brooks Koepka. But everybody needs a couple of holes to get used to that, especially when it's going to be here, you know, in New Jersey at Liberty National. I mean, you know better than I do what those crowds are going to be like.
Sure, exactly. Well, Rex, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to come talk to me. Really appreciate it, and enjoy your stay in New York.
Appreciate it.
All right, you're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia.